Hello everyone, and welcome back to this History and Stuff podcast. I know I've been gone now for quite a while. I've been very busy with work, but I have a few days off now for the Easter break, so I decided that I would whip up a brand new episode for you guys, so hopefully you'll enjoy it. Today we're not going to talk about Swedish history, as we've done mostly on this podcast, but we're going to talk about another part of history that I find very interesting, and I hope you will find it interesting as well. And what we're going to talk about today is mainly the history of the Mongols. And you probably heard of the Mongols once or twice, but I want to maybe give you some more information about their history, their culture, and what actually happened when they took over large parts of the world. And the Mongols is an example of how, in general, historical theories have moved away from the great man view of history. We don't really view history as being pushed by the great leaders or the great men as much as we did before. But in a few cases, you still have to look back at individual people as really the big movers. And I think this is one of those cases, because if it wasn't for the man called Temujin, later known as Genghis Khan, I don't really know if this would have happened at all. Because he came from a people of nomadic steppe tribes that had lived on the Central Asian steppes for hundreds, if not thousands of years, grazing their animals, their sheep, their cows, their horses, and mainly fighting once in a while with the neighboring sedentary peoples, the Chinese, once in a while the Europeans, but rarely making a very large threat. With a few exceptions, of course. We have the Xiongnu Federation that attacked China all the way back in around the year around the birth of Christ, as well as the famous Huns that attacked both Europe as well as parts of Asia in the 3rd and 4th century, or even 5th century, as well as the Gokturks, who took over a large part of Central Asia hundreds of years ago. But these people tended to not be very united. They were different people. They spoke different languages, and often not even that related languages. And a lot of people moved in and moved out, and they didn't have really that much unity. They fought each other as much as they fought the sedentary peoples. And in fact, the sedentary peoples that lived around them tended to play them off against each other. So, for example, the Chinese would pay one of these tribes, let's say the Jurchen, to fight off the Mongols. And they would do that happily for some money. And they would keep them in check that way. And they were mostly just an annoyance. I mean, they were a serious annoyance at times. That's why they started building the Great Wall of China, for example. But most of the time, they were not unified. But when they were unified, as with the Huns, they were quite a serious threat. Because they were very skilled horse archers, and they were very skilled soldiers, and they often were much more skilled at riding than the other people, and they tended to have more foot soldiers and just come in greater numbers than the Mongols. And the Mongols tended to not be very materially wealthy, as a lot of nomads were not. They had their yurts, and they had their cattle, and they had their horses, of course, and they tended to live off these animals. They lived off lamb meat, they lived off horse meat, and they lived off horse milk, and they even made a specific alcoholic drink out of mare's milk called kumis. And the places of women in the Mongol society was like in a lot of societies that they worked. especially in a lot of societies that wasn't really that materially rich, because everyone had to work, and they worked often alongside the men. And even if they didn't often go into battle, they were still trained to defend themselves with the bow and arrow. And they also trained the younger boys to ride horses. And when Genghis Khan, or Temujin, came onto the scene, he wasn't really that much of a leader. His father was a minor tribal leader among the Mongols, but it wasn't really anything big. And he would soon gather a small band of followers, and he was very skilled at using both diplomacy when he could and ruthless murder when he couldn't. So he tended to befriend some tribes, and he just completely wiped out other tribes that didn't agree with them. And his idea was to unify the Mongol tribes and basically conquer the world. And that's not hyperbole. The idea was really to conquer everything. That's what the word Genghis Khan actually means. It means ruler of all the world. So it's more of a title than a name, actually. And Genghis Khan, when he took power and managed to unify the Mongol tribes, the Central Asian tribes, they were not only Mongols, they were also Turkic peoples. He decided to restructure the society in a few different ways. For example, the Mongols didn't have a written script before him, so he decided to adopt the Uyghur Turk script system and adapt it for Mongolian. He also reformed how the army worked, and it wouldn't be based on heritage and your inherited status anymore, or even on loyalty, but on competence. So the best commanders would be placed higher up in the army, which was very popular among people who came from outside, which had an older aristocratic view of things. So the lower classes tended to favor this, since it wasn't just the nobility that got to be commanders, but you could actually climb based on merit. And first of all, Genghis Khan turned his face to the Jurchen state of Jin, which was in northern China. And the Jurchen was also a nomadic people from the beginning. And they had often fought against the Mongols. And the Mongols slowly but surely began to conquer the Jurchen. It wasn't really a super fast conquest that would come later on, but there were a few kinks in the system, and they needed to figure out a few things. For example, how to take a city, which they weren't really that good at, because they had horses, and horses can't climb walls, if you want to be blunt about it. But they managed to figure that out. And one of the things that they were great at later on was adapting strategies from the peoples they had conquered and adapting it into their own fighting. And after they had conquered the Jurchen of the north, they moved on to southern China, or what was called the Song Dynasty. And this conquest took a lot longer than the northern conquest, because it was a much larger state, and they didn't really manage to conquer all of it in the first try. But they did conquer cities such as Beijing and burnt it almost to the ground. But before that, before the conquest of China, something else happened. The Khan sent envoys to the ruler of Persia, or Khwarezmian, and asked him to submit. It was not a declaration of war or anything like that, but the Shah decided that he wouldn't have it and sent back the heads of the envoys on pikes, basically. This was not met with a kindness by the Khan, who decided to take revenge. And this led to the conquest of Persia, or Khwarezmia, which was unbelievably violent and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people died in this conquest. And the Mongols didn't really have that massive of an army. They had 100,000 men about there, which of course is very big, but not necessarily much bigger than any other state. But they did have superior tactics and superior strategy and superior speed. In fact, a lot of people think that the numbers of the Mongolian armies are vastly exaggerated in a lot of sources because they didn't understand how one army could be at so many different places. They thought that one army was several armies because they moved so fast. And whole cities were torn to the ground, especially in Khwarezmia, because of this insult. And a lot of the survivors were also enslaved. And following this conquest, they continued to move in west and north, conquering what was known as the Rus principalities, today's Russia. It wasn't really a united state at the time. There were many disparate kingdoms. And they actually managed to move all the way up to what is today's southern Finland, what's the sort of borderlands of the Mongol conquest. And they continued to move into Europe. And for quite a while, the European rulers were very nervous that the Mongols would just sweep in and basically conquer all of Europe. Because when they faced the Hungarian armies and the Polish armies, they couldn't stop them at all. They were completely crushed. And these were some of the strongest armies in Europe at the time. So there were a great tribulation, and people thought that we know, how are we going to save ourselves? But lucky for the Europeans, the Khan died. So they had to go back all the way to Mongolia, which was, of course, several months, if not years, in order to elect a new Khan in what was called a Kurultai, or a Khan election, basically. And they would elect one of the sons of Genghis Khan, because he was dead at this time. And they would elect him as the new Khan. And a lot of other places were affected by the Mongol conquest, as I talked about Persia, but also the Abbasid Caliphate was severely attacked. And Baghdad, which was the center of learning in the Islamic world, was burnt, and a lot of the esteemed scholars and scholarship was destroyed. And this was actually quite controversial even among the Mongols, because they didn't really think it was necessary to burn this city of learning. And the Mongols were not actually that religiously intolerant. It wasn't because they were Muslims. They had a lot of tolerance for all kinds of religions, including Christians, Muslims, Zoroastrians, Buddhists, and of course their own Tengriist belief. But their Tengriist belief was very much tied to the land. It was very much a religion tied to the steppe, so they didn't count on other people joining their religion. And they tended not really to care. In fact, they had quite an amusing strategy. Basically, they would say that to all the people, that just pray to your own gods for the health of the Khan, because one of them is bound to be right, right? So if you have Muslims, Christians, Zoroastrians, and Buddhists all blessing the Khan, you know, one of them has to be right. And finally, after a long time, the Song dynasty actually fell in 1252, even if Genghis Khan was dead at this time. And the Mongols even tried to conquer Japan, but this was unsuccessful because of several different storms that hit the Mongol army. And the Japanese call this divine wind, or more famously, kamikaze, which is the Japanese word for it. Now, the Mongol Empire stretched from southern China all the way up and into northern Russia, and from Turkey until you know what is today North Korea, basically. And this was a huge empire that could not be really kept together. So two generations after Genghis Khan, the empire was divided. And it was divided mainly into four different khanates, which would, in theory, still be connected and still swear fealty to the Great Khan. But in practice, these would develop into separate states pretty fast. Some of them would even collapse pretty soon after, and others would live quite a bit longer, but they would never be united ever again. And the fealty to the Great Khan was ceremonial rather than anything else. And these four khanates was the Yuan dynasty, ruled by Kublai Khan, which was the Great Khan, which was basically just China and Mongolia and some other areas. Then you had the Chagatai Khanate, which was the Central Asian steppe in areas like Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, places like that. Then you had the Ilkhanate, which was mainly the Muslim areas in Persia, today's Iraq, Turkey, in those areas. And their rulers tended to have converted to Islam. And then you had the Golden Horde in Europe, Eastern Europe, in Russia, and in today's Romania, and areas around there. And these kingdoms were not at all as successful as the Great Khanates. The Yuan was overthrown by the Ming after a few hundred years, and the Golden Horde managed to hang on for a time. A sub-state of the Golden Horde, called the Crimean Khanates, actually managed to hang on all the way until 1783, when it was conquered by the Russian Empire. And the ancestors, or the predecessors of these people, the Crimean Tartars, still live there today. And also the Tartars of Russia had some heritage from the Mongols. And there is also a people called the Kalmyks, which still even speak a Mongolian language, that live in southern Russia. And they are mainly Buddhists, making them the only people living in Europe that are mainly Buddhist. And the Mongols also had other lasting impacts, such as the predecessors of the Mughal dynasty in India. And the word Mughal just basically means Mongol. They were seen as the followers of the Mongols, and so they were, but they were quite a few centuries after that, and they weren't really Mongols in any recognizable sense. And also Tamerlane came a few centuries after and swept Central Asia once again, with the characteristic brutality of the Mongols. And I think the Mongols are a great example of how atrocities tend to fade with time, and how many people almost fetishize this period of conquest and empire, even if it was so violent. And I think that's one thing of almost overcorrection, right? Because at first, when people spoke of the Mongol Empire, they tended to only focus on, you know, them being barbarians and how savage they were and how they killed everyone and things like that. And then people started to talk about more the positive things, such as the expansion of trade, even if it also led to the Black Death, which is a shame. And they talked about the religious tolerance and how it was actually quite an efficient empire once you were conquered, and how you probably lived better there than in many other places. And all of that might be true, but we shouldn't also forget that millions and millions of people were killed. And these are numbers that are so staggering that you almost had to reach for like World War II before you get up to those kinds of numbers again. Like tens of millions of people slaughtered with sword and arrow, They didn't have mechanized warfare yet. And there are even some people that think that the small Ice Age or the little Ice Age were kind of caused by the Mongols' slaughter and how basically they rewilded areas that had previously been inhabited. Although that's kind of hard to decide. But I think we should not forget that these were actually real people that were killed by the Mongols, and that, you know, there aren't just characters in a story. They were actually real people. And I would like now to end on a short story about how the Mongols responded to a letter from the Pope. Because around this time, the Pope was, of course, very, very worried about the Tartars, as they were known, and how they were ravaging Christian states in Eastern Europe. Of course, they mainly cared about the Christians. But they didn't really know that much about them. And as I said, they actually called them the wrong name. They called them the Tartars. And the Pope decided to send a letter, basically saying, stop what you're doing and become Christian, and stop attacking Christians. Of course, he wrote it in Latin, because what would he speak in Mongolia other than Latin? And he just basically sent an envoy, just go east until you find some Mongols. And that's what he did. He went east and he eventually came to Russia, where he encountered some Mongols. And of course, they didn't understand him. So he had to speak to some Russians that knew Latin, and then the Russians had to translate to another language, and eventually they translated it into Mongolian. So he basically realized that, okay, we have an envoy here. So we sent him back to Mongolia. So he was sent out to Mongolia, probably the first European to visit Mongolia and leave, and visit it voluntarily. And he eventually came to the Mongol court at Karakorum, which was the capital of the Mongol Empire. And there he actually met some other Christians, to his great surprise, because the Mongols, as I said, there were a lot of Christians in the Mongol Empire, and not just the Russians or other Christian peoples that had been conquered. A lot of the Mongols were actually Christians themselves. Some early missionaries, notably the Nestorians, had sent missionaries out east, and some of the Mongols had adopted Nestorian Christianity. Of course, there were also Muslims and Buddhists and other people like that. And the letter he had sent to the Khan was quite interesting because it was, of course, in Latin, but it also was not really a letter that you would send to someone that doesn't know what Christianity or Catholicism is. It was more like a demand to accept these very specific doctrines of Christianity that we have. And of course, the Mongols responded with, we don't really understand what you're saying. Why should we baptize ourselves? Like, what is the point? And we won't stop attacking the Christians unless you come and stop us, basically. And they also said that, well, if your God is so mighty, why don't he stop us? He lets us conquer all these people, so surely this is your God's will. Which is almost kind of like what the Catholics would almost say themselves. Like, if God allows this, then it must be some punishment for some terrible crime. And this story is in greater length in Dan Carlin's series on the Mongols. I recommend it highly. It's very long, but if you have the patience, he has some great stories about the Mongol Empire. Otherwise, the contents of this podcast has mainly come from A History of World Societies by McKay and several others. It's a university course book. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. It's a shorter one than usual, but hopefully it's a good one. And I'll see you when I see you next time. Goodbye.